This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
That's really our focus right now, is because we see the potential of this crop. One plant gives up to 40 kgs of nutrient storable food, right? So we see the impact of that on the ground.
Studies have shown that international economic aid can be an important component of a developing country's economy, but that too much aid can actually be harmful, undermining local enterprise and other indicators of independence. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Shannon Fernando, the founder and CEO of Alabaster International, a small nonprofit with some big plans to make a significant impact in the global south. We look at her organization's model, learn about the promising African staple crop NSET, and discuss the challenges of trying to provide short-term assistance to vulnerable populations while also setting the table for long-term economic health. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Shannon Fernando. She is the CEO and founder of Alabaster International. Shannon, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much. So nice to be here.
So your nonprofit, Alabaster International, it's a very intriguing idea. The concept is far-reaching and could impact millions and millions of lives. Why don't you give us a snapshot of your organization first?
Great. Thanks so much. So Alabaster International, we partner with Indigenous women and families in conflict-affected or marginalized communities, particularly those who are quite impoverished. And we partner with them to combat hunger in the region. So we work particularly in East Africa, in South Sudan, Ethiopia, and Kenya. And our work around combating hunger focuses on regenerative agriculture led by women.
And what was the light bulb moment that allowed you to create this organization?
So I am a family nurse practitioner by profession. And so I've been caring for patients actually here in LA with people experiencing homelessness in the Skid Row community. But at the same time, I started working, founded Alabaster, started working in Kenya and then eventually the other two countries, caring for patients, particularly children, that were malnourished. And we really started to see the impact of malnourishment, particularly during the pandemic. And that really led us to really identify what are some sustainable solutions to hunger that we can create, starting with what's already in communities versus parachuting in a solution or relying on external food aid. And so that's really what caused us to begin to work in the regenerative agriculture space, and also why I decided to start Alabaster because of the experiences that I was seeing on the ground.
Why don't you explain the connection you have with the Clinton Global Initiative and how that's going to hopefully assist in your organization's expansion?
So we're really honored to partner with the Clinton Global Initiative for a second year. So last year, we introduced our regenerative agriculture project focused on NSET, which is a remarkable crop, probably one that you've never heard of. And I'd love to get into that further. But basically, we partnered with CGI last year to introduce that project, and it's going very successfully. And so now, this year, we're building off of that project by introducing an AI component, combining that with women Indigenous knowledge regarding farming NSET.
Yeah, explain what NSET is. It's a fascinating crop that most Americans have never heard of, but it's a staple food in the regions that you're focusing on.
So NSET is a banana-like crop. It's indigenous to Ethiopia. So it's a staple food for actually 20 million Ethiopians, particularly in the southern and southwest region of Ethiopia. And what's remarkable about it is it's drought tolerant. It's perennial, so you can grow it year-round and harvest it year-round. And it's quite nutritious, high in carbohydrates, starch, and vitamin B12, calcium, iron. And so one big thing that we found when we came across NSET is there's 50 years of research showing that NSET is sort of the next answer to hunger in Africa, particularly in Africa, with the potential to feed up to 100 million people. But one of the big restrictions was that there were not in place any sharing agreements between Ethiopia and other countries for justifiable reasons. And so Alabaster, we were able to secure the first ever agreement between Ethiopia and their neighbor Kenya to share NSAID across the international borders so we could understand its regional impact on food security.
So I had never heard of NSAID until a few hours ago when I was reading up on it. And I was fascinated by the fact that it's like a banana plant, but it doesn't produce edible fruit. The food source is the stalk, essentially. It's almost like this bread-like food that's coming from the stalk. So you said it's drought-resistant. How easily can it be grown in different latitudes? Like, is this a crop that could be grown in South Africa or Morocco, or is it, will it be confined to the Sudanese-Ethiopian band that you're focusing on?
Great question. So essentially what the research currently shows is NSAID, so it's growing in Ethiopia, obviously it's indigenous there. The wild types of NSAID, so the types that are not currently eaten, they actually grow throughout the South and East African region already. But the cultivated form that's actually the one that's edible, that's the form that's only in Ethiopia. And so right now, because of that agreement that I mentioned, now NSAID is growing in field trials in Kenya, showing that it can now grow in different altitudes as well as soils and, you know, different climatic conditions for the first time in history, essentially. So now we have NSAID growing at, you know, low elevation, as well as in Ethiopia, it grows at high altitudes or high elevation. So it does have a quite expansive variation in which it can grow. It can also grow in hotter climates as well as in cooler climates. But the really dry, arid areas is what we are currently testing to see how it will do in those conditions.
So I was just thinking of some of these staple crops and what's kind of been their silver bullet, something that sets them apart and makes them very useful to mass appeal. For example, rice, yes, it uses a lot of water in the growing, but then you have these tiny little beads, you know, the grains of rice, which can then be transported and stored very easily. And then it can be quite nourishing, and it's thousands of years of culture and cuisine. Similarly, bread, wheat is not the easiest thing to grow, but bread is not so easy to store. I guess you can freeze it and things like that, but it's not the most efficient way to get calories into people. How does NSAID stack up in terms of its storage capability? And you mentioned how 20 million people use it, but that's relatively a small swath of the African population. So will it be appealing to a wide range of palates if you try to introduce it to different cultures?
Absolutely. That's something that we've been, you know, considering and thinking about through our work, because we don't want to introduce a crop to a community and they, you know, don't want to eat it. They don't like it. They can't assimilate it into their normal diet. And so what we've been doing is we've been launching these essentially these campaigns, but that's an interesting word, but these demonstrations, I would say, where we go into different communities and we partner with women in the community and we let them eat NSAID, we let them taste it, we let them cook with it, and they can give us feedback on how they like it, they don't like it. And so that's how we've been able to assess its acceptance and tolerance as a new food product. And so that's been really successful so far. We've done that in Kenya and in some newer parts of Ethiopia, where NSAID is not currently, you know, eaten. And so again, this is not it's not a one and done process. This is development work. So it's a constant going back and forth with communities to make sure they feel heard, they feel listened to, and they feel comfortable with the product. And so that's why, you know, it's been taking some time. We've done this now for about a year, and we're still continuing to work with communities to assess get their feedback on how they can integrate it into their normal diet.
Oh, when you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby, baby. Yeah. is when you laughing. Ba 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 bo do when you laughing. Yes, the sun comes shining through.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Shannon Fernando. She's the founder and CEO of Alabaster International. So, Shannon, we're talking about this regenerative agriculture campaign that's spearheaded by this crop NSET, which is more popular in the Ethiopian region of Africa. What is NSETs? How resilient is it once it's been packaged for consumption?
Essentially, NSAID, as we talked about, it's not the fruit that you eat, but it's actually the stalk of the tree that's basically peeled off, and there's a pulp that emerges from that scraping and peeling of the stalk. And then that pulp, there's two things you can do with it. You can dry it and use it as a flour, like you would like an all-purpose flour. And that obviously can be used for probably up to a year, right, in terms of the shelf life or even more. But what's more common is that what communities do with that pulp is they actually put it into the ground to ferment it. And once it's in the ground, it can stay in the ground for up to 6 to even 9 months, where they can then utilize it anytime they want during that time. It's kind of like a underground refrigerator, so to speak, where they put it into the ground and it goes through the fermentation process. And that allows them to access the NSAID pulp at any time they want. And then they can use that to make bread or porridge or other items.
So it's like a sourdough starter, or like the way Koreans would use kimchi traditionally and ferment it in their backyards.
Exactly. Exactly.
And why don't you give us some idea of the most popular ways to consume it? When could I taste it in an Ethiopian restaurant, for example? How would I eat it?
Great. So two main ways. There's two kinds of products that an NSAID tree can produce. One is kocho or bula. So kocho is the, like I mentioned, that stalk that that you get a pulp from, and then you put that into the ground to ferment. And then once that fermentation process is done, it's about a month or so at the least, then you eat that as kocho. And that can essentially be made into like a chapati, like a pancake, or bread, or even biscuits. So those are the common things. Like, so in Ethiopian restaurants, especially in Addis, the capital, you'll find that there's kocho biscuits, right? So these, and they have kind of a soury taste because of the fermentation process. You can eat it with cheese or butter or any kind of a savory biscuit.
But is it a little dense, like taro?
Yes, exactly. It has a little, and it's a little bit chewy. It's chewy. So yeah, it's a little bit more dense than like a wafer. And then the second way is bula. Bula is actually the pulp that I mentioned. They squeeze it to get a more refined liquid or milk-like material, liquid. And then that actually can be used to make porridge. And so that's very popular among pregnant women because of the vitamin B12 levels. But in restaurants or kind of mainstream, what you'll see more of is the kocho.
So let's think about the logistics that you and your organization have been implementing in trying to spread the gospel, if you will, of NSAID. How have you been connecting with larger NGOs and governments? And what needs to happen to really accelerate this crop and make it more ubiquitous?
So we've been really grateful, because one of the biggest strengths of our work and our project is the community buy-in and the community rapport. So that's Alabaster's model in general, is we always go in as listeners, partners, and we let local communities lead us and guide us. So we have a whole team of especially women, but also male farmers that are supporting the work, giving us feedback, letting us know what's working, what's not working in terms of barriers that they're facing to scale NSAID in their community, what kinds of inputs they need. Is it more seedlings? Is there a disease that's impacting their crop? And so we need to assist them with that. And so that's been really, really positive and has ensured that our work is really farmer-centric and led by them. So our work, we always say our work is co-designed, co-implemented with local communities on the ground. And then the second thing I'll say is we have a lot of great buy-in from local and national government agencies. We're working with the Ministry of Agriculture in Ethiopia. We're working with the Ethiopian Biodiversity Institute. And so those partners, in addition to more local partners as well, like regional agricultural bureaus, have been supporting us to make sure that we're aligned with their national priorities.
So one of the things that you tout on your website is this empowerment over short-term aid, which is a little bit of a tricky tightrope for a lot of philanthropic organizations to toe, because sometimes in emergencies we need short-term aid. And also there's this bootstraps mentality that we've seen from the right wing over the last four decades in this country, where they're all like, you know, I'm not going to give you the fish, but I'll give you the pole, you know, that kind of idea. How are you able to thread that needle, Shannon?
So I think for us, we very much agree that short-term aid, you know, the food drops or acute situations, crisis situations require that. And I think there are great organizations that do that work, like, you know, WFP, World Food Program, and other agencies that do that work. For Alabaster, our focus is really on starting with what's already in communities versus bringing in something that creates an external dependency. And so while in crisis situations, those are needed, what we're focused on is what's going to impact these communities 10 years from now. So we're visioning for the future versus not just for the immediate needs of the community, while that is, of course, important. And so, and that's mirrors NSAID in general, because NSAID is not really meant to fill like quick needs like a sorghum or a maize. NSAID takes about 2 to up to 4 years to mature to give the biggest yield of food. And so once it's matured, again, it's a perennial crop that is like a living refrigerator we can go to at any time to get food. So that really mirrors our model of empowerment, meaning we're starting with an indigenous crop that's already existing, that farmers already know how to farm, and now looking to scale that knowledge, which has been there for thousands of years in these communities, to now enable new farmers to utilize NSAID as a food source. Again, with that long-term perspective in mind.
So as a Los Angeles-based nurse, before you became the CEO and founder of Alabaster International, what countries were kind of your templates for creating Alabaster International? I'm thinking, for example, in Haiti, after the earthquake there devastated the economy, there's a lot of different short-term aid that didn't necessarily create a strong foundation for healthy growth. So there has been this outcry in Haiti for more empowerment type NGOs. Where are you looking for inspiration to create your methodology with Alabaster?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, I was in Haiti after the earthquake doing medical work there. And so I did definitely see that synergy of short-term critical aid that's needed on the ground versus also working with the local leaders to put in long-term infrastructure, right? What it's like, just from a healthcare perspective, how do we rebuild health facilities? How do we train? How do we make sure that when these emergency NGOs that are on the ground are at leave, right? What is going to be remaining that can continue and even grow the work on the ground? And so I think honestly, being in Haiti, it's like funny that you brought up the example, but being in Haiti after the earthquake, but even looking at the pandemic in Los Angeles and how us, especially caring for people experiencing homelessness, you know, those on the very margins of our community, looking at how absolutely we needed short-term support to get testing out there, right? And to make sure we got people quarantined if they didn't have a home to shelter in place in, right? But then at the same time, we needed to look to how do we put in infrastructure that will set us up well for the next pandemic, if that ever happens, right? How do we put in testing that's integrated into primary care, right? How do we make sure that therapeutics and immunizations long-term can be integrated so that we set communities up well? And so I think a combination of my international work in Haiti, I did some work in the Philippines and in Sri Lanka as well. I was there after the tsunami hit in 2004 and saw very similar the influx of short-term and absolutely critical aid, but also looking at, and I'm originally from Sri Lanka, so, and then looking at now what's needed over time to put in infrastructure. And I think the critical gap that I see, whether in Sri Lanka, in Haiti, even in the during the pandemic in the US, was the long-term infrastructure takes longer. and it tends to be a lot of funding needed for a longer period of time with outcomes that take longer to sort of get to, that may not look as great on paper initially, but will actually actually equate to sustainable infrastructure that leaves communities no longer dependent on the external aid. So I think that's the thing that is a push and pull, is because you need both. But I think for Alabaster, what we wanted to focus on is we want to go into community and no longer be needed. You know, so we don't want to create a system where farmers are now dependent on Alabaster coming in and providing them with the tools they need or the seedlings they need long term. Initially, absolutely, but not 30 years from now. So that's, I think, where I get our perspective and where the model is based from.
Together with one another, out of their problems and out of their quarrels, and try to live as brothers, and try to find peace within without stepping on one another, and do respect to the women of the world. Just remember, we all had mothers.
Make this land a better land and a world in which we live,
and help each man be a better man with the kindness that you give. I know we can make it. I know darn well we can work it out.
Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Okay. If we want, yes, we can.
I know we can make it work. I know we can make it if we try.
Oh, yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Break the system.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Shannon Fernando. She's the founder and CEO of Alabaster International. So, Shannon, why don't you explain the challenges that a nonprofit your size faces, and also if you can tell us where you are in terms of headcount and financial health, that would be terrific.
Yeah, thanks so much for that. So some of the challenges we're as a nonprofit and any nonprofit right now is facing is just the decrease in global giving, right? So I think with the shuttering of US aid and then just the domino effect of that, we've just seen a lot more hesitancy for different funding agencies to come in and fund new projects, because obviously there's now existing projects that have less funding. And so obviously sustaining those, making sure the communities that have already been committed to can have those resources. So I think that's really been challenging for us, because we're asking people to come alongside us to do the unprecedented, right? As you mentioned, NSAID is relatively unknown, but we have evidence both from local communities and actually, you know, research studies that show the impact of this. But again, it's always this sense of, hey, we're doing something that's delving into the unknown, into some mystery, right? And we're also asking funders, investors come alongside something that's going to establish food security and climate resilience and economic empowerment for communities maybe 5 years from now, right? Not in the next year, perhaps. And so I think those are all makes it challenging in terms of pitching and getting partners on the ground. We're so grateful, you know, for CGI as an example, for, you know, featuring our work and getting us in front of different funders and partners to be able to look at how to scale and set. Because our current project, going to your second part of your question, our current initiative has impacted close to 40,000 people between Ethiopia and Kenya. And that's because we've been able to establish community nurseries with NSAID. We've established 5 women-owned businesses with NSAID. And so we've seen already the impact of this, but now we need to scale, right? We want to go from that 40,000, and our dream and our vision is to get to 15 million. And that's just in the Ethiopia-Kenya region. You know, we're not even talking about the potential for outside of that. And so I think really to get there right now, you know, we're considered a small organization. We have an operating budget of less than $500,000. And so our dream is to get to that $1 million operating budget as a start within the next 6 to 9 months, really, so that we can have enough resources to start to scale NSET. And of course, the other work we do work in healthcare and education and other programs, but really for NSET, that's really our focus right now, is because we see the potential of this crop. One plant gives up to 40 kgs of nutrient storable food, right? So we see the impact of that on the ground. And so that's what we're really asking for and hoping for in terms of partnership.
What are some of the other areas you see Alabaster expanding into?
So Alabaster, we actually have four pillars. Food security is one of them, and that's where the NSET is. And that's actually been our main focus for the last 2 to 3 years. But we have an education focus, and that's actually particularly for conflict zones, working with children and youth for education and peace building. Then we have a female entrepreneurship arm, which again, what I mentioned about the women-owned businesses. So launching women-led, women-owned businesses in these marginalized communities. And then the third is, of course, healthcare. So we employ a mobile medicine model, going into places that don't have easy access to healthcare and bringing care to them. And then we also build permanent infrastructure. So we built 2 maternity centers as well as a clinic so far in our work. So those are our other areas that we work on.
Why don't you explain how your organization is able to dig deep into these local communities without necessarily having thousands of employees?
So our model focuses on identifying 1 to 2 local agencies, whether that's a university or an NGO or a government agency, but most of the time we focus on an NGO or university that will be the local leader for us on the ground. They will be the ones to lead us to communities in need and to identify what programs will really fill the gaps, particularly for hunger. And then we will then work with them to co-employ staff. So essentially the staff is employed by the local agency, but we fund that staff. So essentially we get to work together, co-supervising that staff, and they become the leaders and the people who, like, the implementers of the project on the ground. So that's nice because then we're not paying for offices and cars and all those other things, fax machines, you know, all the different overhead that comes with establishing our own offices on the ground. We instead shunt all that money toward programs and being able to actually get that into communities. So that's how we're able to run things kind of from here with the local assets and the local presence we have on the ground. That being said, I'm in Africa every 3 months. So we are on the ground, you know, again, because we don't like to, we're co-implementers, right? We're not just funders. So we actually go in and actually help establish and design things with communities. And actually we are permanently relocating, my husband and I, to Africa next year. So we are moving from the US there. So again, just to be close to our projects on the ground.
The organization is Alabaster International. Folks can find it at alabasterinternational.org. Shannon Fernando, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Lettuce, Louis Armstrong, and Lee Dorsey.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.